The Talmud as a work of scholarship was done over many, many centuries. It's not a one-time event. The Mishnah is edited in about the year 200 of the Common Era. The Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, is edited in about the year 550 of the Common Era. So it's 350 years of constant conversation, discussion, teachings that are recorded in the Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi, was edited in about the year 350, 360, and it's much more concise because it only reflects 150 years of conversations and teachings. And the Talmud Yerushalmi came to an end because of the fact that the Byzantine Christians took over the land of Israel, and they persecuted the Jews unmercifully, really had a program of genocide. So the Jewish community in the land of Israel disintegrated. And most of them moved to Babylonia. Some of them began the trek up into Turkey and the Balkans, eventually reaching Europe. It also is in about the year 360, 359, 360, that in the land of Israel, when the Sanhedrin was dissolved completely, that the permanent calendar that we have was established, the calendar by which we reckon the time, the years, and the holidays. So all of that happened in the middle of the fourth century. But Babylonian Jewry kept on going. The Babylonian Jewry had the good fortune that it escaped pretty much Christian rule. It remained pagan. And in an odd sort of way, the pagans were much more tolerant to the Jews than the Christians. In paganism, you know, if you have 100 gods, you're going to have 101 gods. And so it didn't pose the direct confrontational problem that Christianity and Judaism had to deal with. Now, Babylonia was ruled by different rulers. It was divided up into city-states, into counties. It wasn't one central government. All of this would change when the Muslims come in the 600s. And that's one of the reasons why the whole Talmudic adventure ends. When the Muslims come, so then the Caliph of Baghdad, he becomes the ruler of the entire country, not in the entire country, he thinks of the entire world. You have a different situation completely. Now, the Jews were in Babylonia for a long period of time. They were there from about 500 years before the Common Era. And they had institutions there that were created at the time of the prophet Ezekiel, the time of the Novi Yechezkel, right after the destruction of the first temple. There were main cities of Jewish population. The Jews lived all along the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, and they were merchants. They were artisans, they were in agriculture, and they were a very strong presence in the country. We don't have exact numbers, but we're probably talking about between 500,000 and 750,000 people as Jews in Babylonia. So they were a very strong presence. They're 15, 20, 30% of the country. And in many of the cities, they're the majority people in the city. And therefore, you had the Jewish cities in Babylonia. The there were a number of major Jewish cities. One was called Sura. Sura became famous. The prophet Yechezkel lived there. Prophet Yechez, when Iraq will eventually become visitable, if there is such a word, so I'm sure the Israeli tour guides will take us to Iraq there. The The tomb of the Navi Yecheskel exists. The tomb of the Navi Yonah exists. It's a place of ancient Jewish history. And even if we don't know where the tomb is, the guides will find it. There's no question about it. So it's all there. So Sura was a major city. Now, Sura declined, but then it had a great revival under the great teacher who was called Rav. Now, Rav and was the first generation of the Amoraim who constructed the Talmud. There are seven generations to span the 350 years. He is the first generation. And he's a disciple of Rebbe, of Rabbi Yehuda Anossi. He was a Babylonian by birth. He came to the land of Israel to study. He went back. And when he came back the first time, he was unsuccessful. Nobody appreciated him. Came back to the land of Israel again. He studied a second time. Went back again. Again, he was unappreciated. He had no office. Went back a third time. And he stayed until Rabbi Yehuda Anossi died. After the death of Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, he went back. He's already in his 60s, which to us is not old at all. But in those days, to begin a career in your 60s, but this time he was enormously successful. And the Talmud says that Rav Biko Motzo, he found an open valley, and he is the one that fenced it in. He is the one that created Torah and Bovel. So, and he had a great yeshiva in Sura. So that's one place. There's a second city called Nahardoeh. Nahardoeh literally means on the river. The river is the Euphrates. And in Nahardoeh, there is Rav's colleague, a man who is called Shmuel, Mar Shmuel, Mr. Shmuel, because he never received rabbinic ordination. Now, Shmuel is a great scholar, a great Talmud Chacham. He's a doctor, he's an astronomer, he's a mathematician. And in Nahardoeh, he has a great yeshiva. And Rav and Shmuel are the first generation of Amoraim in Bavel. When Rav and Shmuel die, Rav Huna, who's the second generation of Amoraim, becomes the successor to Rav in Sura. Nahardoeh declines. They could not find, the problem always is who comes after a great person. Less great people are more easily replaceable. But a person like Shmuel, and he's everything, he's close to the government, he knows languages, he's the great Talmud Chacham, he's the head of the yeshiva, he's the whole thing. They couldn't find such a person. So therefore what happened was that Nahardoeh declined after the death of Shmuel, and Sura remains the main yeshiva in Bavel. In Sura, they had 1,200 regular students, year-round students, and then on the Yarchei Kala, the 2 months of the year that they devoted to Torah study, so the number went up tenfold. There were 12,000 that came to hear the Torah lessons. The months of the Kala were the months of Adar and the month of Elul. Those were the 2 months of the year. People took off from their occupations, they left their homes, they left their wives. It's really a good idea to leave your wife after Purim, and because then let her pachka with Pesach, right? Because you're only in the way anyway. So they had these great events. The Talmud says that everybody sat on the ground to hear the shiurim, and they had dirt floors. And when they got up, the Gemara says you could see the pillar of smoke, the pillar of dust, rather, that their feet made all the way to the land of Israel. So Rav Huna becomes the head of the yeshiva in Sura. Now, all of the Gemara goes in pairs. There are two people, two colleagues at the same time. So just like there was Rav and Shmuel, so there was Rav Huna and Rav Chisda. And Rav Huna was the head of the yeshiva. And when Rav Huna passed away, Rav Chisda succeeded him as the head of the yeshiva in Sura. There was a third person now, whose name was Rav Yehuda Bar Yecheskel. Rav Yehuda Bar Yecheskel lived in the third city called Pumpedisa. Pumpedisa is on the Tigris, not on the Euphrates. And Pumpedisa was a well-known town of, what shall we say, sharp businessmen. You had to keep your hands in your pockets if you were in Pumpedisa. And it had that reputation. An unlikely place to become a Mokum Torah, to become a place of Torah study, a place of Jewish greatness. But since Rav Yehuda Bar Yecheskel lived there, he created a yeshiva, and the yeshiva in Pumpedisa eventually outshone the yeshiva in Sura. And Rav Yehuda Bar Yecheskel had many, many students. And he was a very, very strong personality. Now, during this period of time, there's a competition between the land of Israel, between Eretz Yisrael, and between Bavel. You can imagine there's a competition in the yeshivas. Eretz Yisrael has got Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, who are in Tveria, in Tiberias. They have the Chachmei Caesarea, the great wise men of the city of Caesarea, which had also great yeshivas and great leaders. And because of that, there was always a flow of students from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael. There also was a backwash of flow of Babylonians who came to the land of Israel and who brought the ideas of the land of Israel and the teachings of the rabbis of the land of Israel to the Babylonian yeshivas as well. They were called Rabbanan Nechote, the rabbis that went down, the rabbis that went up. And there are a number of such people in the Talmud who apparently do nothing but travel between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, spend a year in Eretz Yisrael studying, come back to Bavel, they spend a year in Bavel teaching what they learned in Eretz Yisrael and hearing what the Chachamim and Bavel have to say, and then they go back to Eretz Yisrael. So you have this cross-pollination of Torah going on between somewhat today that we have, for instance, between the yeshivas in the United States and the yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. You have Talmidim that come here for years and then they go back, and you have Talmidim from here that go there, and the rabbis have discussions between themselves. So it constantly enlivens the study of Torah. Now, in Pumpedisa, Rav Yehuda Bar Yecheskel really creates a great yeshiva, a very strong yeshiva. And when he dies, so then by the time that he died, and we're talking here about the year close to 300, the third generation of Amoraim enter. I'm going to talk about the third generation today. I know it said on the sheet that I was going to talk about Rav Nachman or Rav Sheshes, but I'm going to do that tomorrow night. I'm going to talk about Rabba and Rav Yosef tonight. So the third generation of Amoraim, they need a successor to Rav Yehuda Bar Yecheskel in Pumpedisa. There are two candidates, both disciples of Rav Yehuda. Now, Rav Yehuda had a policy. He did not want his students to go to the land of Israel. And he expressed it. In fact, he said, anyone that leaves Babylonia to go to the land of Israel transgresses upon the words of the prophet, because it says, Vayavoo Bavel, they came to Babylonia, Vishom, and there they should remain till the Messiah will bring them back. Bavela Yavo. And there are different reasons that can go into it, he did not at all encourage, to put it mildly, so that the Gemara tells us that his students that wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael never went to say goodbye to him. Because if they would say goodbye to him, he would be insulted, and he would tell them not to go, and they didn't want to transgress directly over orders given to them. So the Gemara's lashon is ishtamute. They always hid. All of a sudden one day they weren't there anymore. Those that won, and there were many that did go to Eretz Yisrael, in spite of his opinion. But when he dies, Pumpedisa needs a head, and he has two main disciples who are head and shoulders above everyone else, who are the third generation of Amoraim. One is Rabba Bar Nachmeni, and the other one is Rav Yosef. And those are the two people that I'm going to discuss with you here tonight for the remaining minutes that we have, which to you will feel like hours. Rabba Bar Nachmeni is a genius. He is called Oker Horim. He can uproot the mountains. He is sharp. His analytical powers are great. And he has that kind of personality as well. Rav Yosef, who is his colleague, is the opposite. And we find that often in the Talmud, that the two people who are put together complement each other because they are two very, very different people. Rav Yosef is called Sinai, meaning he has a tremendous memory. He knows all the traditions of the Talmud. He knows all of the teachings until his time. But he's not especially creative. Rabba Bar Nachmeni is creative. He's putting together, he's uprooting mountains. Rav Yosef is placid. He's gentle in his personality. And Rav Yosef is the expert. If you want to know what the Mishnah said, what the Braita said, what was said in the second generation, what was said in the first generation of Amoraim, what was said in the land of Israel, you asked him because he knew it. Whereas Rabba doesn't have that encyclopedic knowledge, even though he has this great creativity. So the Gemara asks the question, and this is a question that remains in education and in teaching until today. Sinai v'okeh hori miyodif. Who is greater? Who is the one that we should prefer? Someone that is like Rabba, Oker Horim, creative, analytical, genius, sharp. Everybody wants to hear his lectures. Or whether or not we want to have Sinai, we want to have someone like Rav Yosef who has encyclopedic knowledge of everything, and even though it's not as exciting, but nevertheless, that perhaps is the proper conduit for Torah, and especially for Torah Shebaal Peh. That remains so until today. That debate has never been settled in the Jewish world. They took on different forms, but that remains until today a question of education, who should be the leader. So the rabbis didn't know what to decide, so they sent the matter to the rabbis in the land of Israel, that they should answer the question, meaning who should they choose, Rabba, or should they choose Rav Yosef? And the rabbis in the land of Israel answered, Sinai Odif. The one with encyclopedic knowledge is more preferable to head the yeshiva. The Gemara said, Akol tzrichim lamori dechita. Everybody needs the one that has the wheat. In other words, you can be creative and a genius, but if you don't know what it says, so then what value is that? So therefore, we should take Rav Yosef to be the head. Rav Yosef was a very, very modest, humble person. And he did not want the job because the head is always a difficult job. Then he had a dream. And in the dream, he's dreamt that he would be the Rosh Yeshiva after the death of Rabbah Bar Nachmeni. And therefore, he wanted Rabbah Bar Nachmeni to take the position first, and he would wait his turn. What happened was that Rabbah Bar Nachmeni was the head of the yeshiva for 22 years. After he passed away, then Rav Yosef was the head only for 2 years, and then he passed away. So his dream was true, but he did not see himself in the role. So even though the decision apparently was that Sinai Odif, that the one with the encyclopedic knowledge should be the one that should be the head of the institution, it didn't work out that way. Rabbah became the head of the institution. Now, Rabbah and Rabbi Yosef are different people completely. And that's what makes the Talmud so fascinating, is because of the fact that it deals with different people and it reflects them accurately. And the Talmud does not, the Talmud is not the way it is today, that people somehow, we make everybody the same and everybody politically correct, and we minimize any differences between people, and we say that everything is always hunky-dory. That's not the way the Talmud deals with it. The Talmud deals with reality, and it deals with real people, and it tells us the story of real people. Both Rabbah and Rav Yosef are descended from the house of Eli. They're Kohanim. The house of Eli, Eli HaKohen, we read in the book of Shmuel, the house of Eli was cursed that their descendants would not have long lives, that they would not live long. We'll find that in the Talmud also regarding Abaye and Rava, who also came from the house of Eli, and who also people that were under the shadow of this curse of the fact that they would not live long. So there is an opinion in the Talmud that Rabbah only lived till 40. However, better manuscripts have shown us that it should say that he lived until 60. And Rav Yosef lived much longer. Now, Rabbah was very poor. We live at a time when nobody gets paid for being the Rosh Yeshiva. Nobody gets paid for being the rabbi. Nobody gets paid for teaching Torah. That doesn't happen until much later in Jewish history. The first time we find paid rabbinic positions is in 13th century Austria. Until then, you just don't have it. So Rashi's a vintner and the Rambam's a doctor. The Ramban is a doctor, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is a diamond merchant, Rabbi Natam is a banker and a diamond merchant. Nobody is getting paid. Everybody is earning their way. So it's very hard to imagine, because of the great amount of time they spent in Torah and the great knowledge of Torah they had, how they were able to also be successful in commerce, etc. But Rabbah was not very successful. And in fact, the Gemara tells us that there were times that he had difficulty putting food on the table. But it's not reflected in any of Rabbah's. And when you look in the Talmud, you don't know whether Rabbah, he comes across as the teacher. He doesn't come across as someone that is poor. Rav Yosef, on the other hand, is very wealthy, very successful, very wealthy. Rav Yosef, because of his wealth, is very careful of what he does with his money. He's a great philanthropist. He supports the yeshiva with his own money. And he ruefully says that having less is having more when it comes to money. And he says, Yoan Yusor Li Yisrael. A little poverty is good for Jews. Jews handle poverty better than they handle affluence. When it comes to being affluent, the task of dealing with it becomes much more complicated. Poor people somehow are able to do it. Rabbo is also very strict. He's a hard disciplinarian with his students. Rabbo also is very strict with his community. He doesn't cut them any slack. Because of that, they don't like him. The Talmud says they don't like him. When Rabbo died, they had a hard time putting together people to come to the funeral. His nephew, Abaye, who is the from the fourth generation of Amoraim, tells him, Uncle, you should relax your judgments and your behavior towards the people of Pumpedisa because of the fact that they hate you. And that's the word that he uses. They actually hate you. Rav Yosef is beloved. He's Mr. Nice Guy. Two different people. Two different views of how to run the community. Rabbo had terrible tragedies in his lifetime. Relatives died, children died. The Gemara said 60 tragic deaths in his house. Doesn't have a good day. He was so poor, the Gemara says, that at one time he was unable to put up his share for the Eruv that was being put up in his neighborhood for Shabbos. So everybody had to put up money to buy the bread and to build the Eruv. He didn't have any money. He couldn't put it up. He couldn't participate in having the Eruv because of the fact that he was so destitute. What happened was, because of his strong stance in the community, so what happens always when you have a strong stance with the community is that there are people that don't like you. You come to the court, and every Din Torah, there's at least one loser. Most of the time, there are two losers. So nobody likes you when it's over. He earned many enemies, and Pumpedisa was a hard town. As I mentioned before, it was a town that was known for sharp dealings, for living on the edge of the law. It was, people that were in business and felt that money was very important and therefore made compromises. Eventually, he made enough enemies that they informed against him to the government on a trumped-up charge. We're talking Jews who wear tefillin and who are Shomrei Shabbos. We're not talking about, So you have to realize, again, the Gemara portrays for us the community the way it was. And they had false charges against him regarding taxes and other matters. And he had to flee Pumpedisa. When he fled Pumpedisa, one of the charges against him was that he runs the Archikala, that 2 months a year, because of him, the Jews aren't working, because they all come to learn in the yeshiva. And therefore, the government loses tax revenue because the Jews aren't working those 2 months. So he is depriving the government of its revenue, and therefore that's a crime, and he is ordered to be arrested. He flees Pumpedisa, and he wanders, to try and escape from the government agents who are after him. Eventually, he comes back to Pumpedisa. When he comes back to Pumpedisa, he is informed upon again that he's back in town. They come again to arrest him. He hides. At this time, the Gemara phrases it in its own fashion. This time, the angel of death is after him also, the Malach HaMoves. And he dreams the Malach HaMoves, the angel of death, is coming to take him. So the only defense against the angel of death, this is a repetition of the story that the Gemara tells about King David, that as long as the person was studying Torah, the Malach HaMoves was unable to reach him. The angel of death was unable to exercise any power over him as long as the person was engaged in the study of Torah. So Rabbah is studying Torah, and he's hiding behind the palm tree. And he's studying Torah. The wind comes and rustles in the leaves of the palm tree. This is a story in the Talmud, and the metaphor the Talmud tells us. The wind comes and rustles in the leaves of the palm tree. Rabbah is distracted because he thinks that the police are the ones that are coming. He stops learning. The angel of death grabs him. And the last word that he said, he was learning a Mishnah, so the last word that he said was tahor, pure. And so this is a story in the Talmud. This story is repeated regarding the last word, that the last word of Rashi was tahor, the last word of many of the great men, signifying that their soul left this earth betahara, in purity and in holiness. He dies out in the middle of a field under a palm tree. Nobody knows where he is. So the Talmud tells us that his body was shaded by the wings of birds and protected from the vultures and from the animals that ordinarily would come to eat the remains, until he is found by Abaya and Rova, his students. And Abayo is his nephew, and they follow the sound of the birds. All of this is one of these great Talmudic stories. They notice the birds, and they follow the sound of the birds, and they discover his body and bring it to burial. A great windstorm occurs when they're bringing him to burial. Anger in the world, God's anger in the world, at the way Rabbah Bar Nachmeni was treated. And then a passing Arab said, so the passing Arab is really the prophet Elijah, who comes always in different guises. He never looks the way you think he looks. And the prophet Elijah, so he says, Rabboni Shel Olam, the Kol Olam Kulo Shalchoi, the whole world is yours. And Rabbah Bar Nachmeni is yours, and now you've taken him. Why should you be angry at the whole world? And the windstorm abates. So in his lifetime, Rabbah uprooted mountains. He was Oker Horim, and in his death, he also uprooted mountains. Rabbah had children who are mentioned in the Talmud, as two sons of his are mentioned in the Talmud, as being great scholars. His main heir, though, is his nephew, Abaye. Abaye is an orphan. His mother died in childbirth. His father died before Abaye was born. And therefore, he was raised in the house of Rabbah Bar Nachmeni. Rabbah Bar Nachmeni's wife, who is mentioned in the Talmud many times, as a very wise woman, Abaye always quotes her sayings, the things about life that she taught him. And he always says, Omra li aim, my mother told me. But it's not his mother. It's his aunt who raised him from the time that he was an infant. And Rabbah invested in Abaye everything that he had. That's why in the fourth generation of Amoraim, Abaye and Rova are the two main figures, just as in the third generation, Rabbah Bar Nachmeni and Rav Yosef are the two main figures. Rabbah says, again, difference between Rabbah and Rav Yosef. Rabbah says, let the Messiah come, but I don't want to be alive to see when he comes, because the generations that precede the Messiah are so difficult and they have so much pain The Talmud quotes many Amoroyim who said that. I say v'lo ayachmena. Let it come, but I don't want to be there to see it. And we can, our generation and our century can appreciate what they meant. The Mashiach will come, but I don't have to be there to suffer through the pangs of his coming. Rav Yosef says, let him come and I will sit on the dung of his donkey. I am not willing to say that I'm not willing to see that generation and to experience the pangs of the Messiah. His greatness is reflected on every page in the Talmud. We have an interesting thing in the Talmud that the copyists, when they copied the Talmud, confused hundreds of times Rabbah and Rova. Rabbah's with a hey, Reish Bet Hey, and Rova's Reish Bet Aleph. So that's an easy confusion. And therefore, you'll find the Gaon of Vilna, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis de Bach, you'll find all of the other Achronim always working to find whether when it says Rabbah, it means Rabbah or it means Rova. And when it says Rova, does it mean Rova or does it mean Rabbah? So it's like a detective story, and you have to figure it out from other things. And you have to figure it out from other things that they said, and therefore here, what is most likely that the author of this statement is? Who is most likely to be that author? But it's difficult to go more than a page or 2 pages in the Talmud without meeting Rabbah. And the halacha is like Rabbah over Rav Yosef, except for 3 instances in the Talmud. So even though the rabbis decided that the Sinai, the man with the encyclopedic knowledge, is preferable to the Oker Horim, to the creative genius, and therefore Rav Yosef, so to speak, should be greater than Rabbah, but in the practical application, Rabbah was the Rosh Yeshiva 22 years, and Rav Yosef only 2 years, and the halacha is like Rabbah tens of times, while it's only like Rav Yosef 3 times. Now, Rav Yosef was a person, as I mentioned, of great personal wisdom and compassion, well-loved in his town. And the Talmud says that because during the entire 22 years that Rabbah was the head of the yeshiva, Rav Yosef stood at his side and encouraged him and supported him and never for a moment felt that the honor should belong to him, even though the rabbis in Israel said that it should. So therefore, he was privileged to have a longer life, and he was privileged to have wealth, and he was a person of great, we'll see, that the tragedies did not escape him either. None of these people had easy lives. We don't find, you know, life has its curves for us. Rav Yosef said that in matters of doubt, go out and see what the people are doing. He was a people's person. My Amud Dabar, what do the people do? What's the minig of the people? And because of Rav Yosef's attitude towards the people, he is popular with them. He's gentle with them. He doesn't give them a hard time. Also because of the fact that for 22 years, he was not the head of the court. He was not the head of the yeshiva. So he did not make the enemies that Rabbah did. It's only the last 2 years of his lifetime that he is put in this difficult position. Rav Yosef said that one should never take for granted that he will have children who are Torah scholars. And he said the Torah is not an inheritance. It has to be won in every generation. However, he did say that if a family is privileged to have 3 consecutive generations of Torah scholars, then HaTorah Machzeres Al Achsanya Shelo. The Torah returns to its home, to its place. So all the Mefarshim say, however, that that also is not a guarantee. It means it returns, it knocks at the door. But somebody's got to open the door and let it in. So it's like your long-lost relative, right? He comes to visit. So it's your relative and he feels he's part of your family, but if you don't let him in, if you're not hospitable to him, so then it does not become an automatic thing. Rav Yosef was privileged that he had generations of scholars in his family, sons and grandsons, who are mentioned in the Talmud as being Talmudic scholars. Rav Yosef held that the study of Torah was supreme, it was over everything. And that the study of Torah, therefore, he said, even Achav, not only the study of Torah, but the support of Torah, was paramount. And that those who had it, it is the major protection against sin. And even if the person sins, it's the major protection against punishment. He said, for instance, that King Achav, the king of Israel, who was noted for his idolatry and even murder and all of the, and the prophet Elio speaks of him in the harshest terms. He says, nevertheless, he has a share in the world to come because of the fact that he supported Torah and its scholars during his time. Achav had a Mahadrin glat kosher kitchen, the Gemara in Chulin says. So even though he worshipped Avodah Zorah, what's that got to do with having a glat kosher kitchen? The Gemara says that the Gemara says that Eliyahu HaNavi was fed by the birds. He was hiding in the cave. The birds brought him food every day. So the Gemara says, where did the birds get the food? So the Gemara says they got it from the kitchen of Achav. And that Eliyahu could eat it because he knew that the kitchen of Achav was glat kosher, acceptable, Mahadrin. So there's a little tongue-in-cheek in all of this. His reverence for Torah is so great that he says about himself regarding the holiday of Shavuos, date of the anniversary of the giving of the Torah. And so he held that that was the greatest of all holidays because he said, Ilav Hayoma, if it would not be for this day, for the day that the Torah was given, Kama Yosef Viko Bishuka. There are a lot of Yosefs walking around in the marketplace. The reason that I'm Rav Yosef is because of my connection to Torah. And therefore, Torah reigns supreme over everything else. That was on one hand. On the other hand, he preached to his students that they should never take from anybody. It should be completely independent of people. Talmud Chochem shouldn't take money from others. And he said, even if they are poor, they should not beg that others should support them. So he had that double view of the matter, the view of the fact that you're supposed to support them and the fact that they should not be dependent, right? He also said that Yohan Yusol Yisrael, as I mentioned before, even though he was a very wealthy man, he said a touch of poverty is good for Jews. It helps us. Too much is too difficult to handle. He knew his weaknesses. The Gemara says he took a public oath to abstain from alcoholic beverages. And a public oath is an oath that's almost impossible to cancel. It has such a great power, and therefore he took that oath to make certain that he would never drink alcoholic beverages. He characterized himself as having three weaknesses, which he says are terrible character weaknesses. He is too merciful, and these are really problems for a leader, but they're problems for all of us. The Gemara says, Misha Merachim ala Achzorim, a person that has mercy upon those who are cruel ends up being cruel against those who are merciful. So he said he's too merciful, he treats the people too nicely. So you have Rab on one hand who is rigidly strong, and you have Rav Yosef on the other hand who says he's too merciful. He also said he's too quick to anger. He has a temper. And that is a very difficult trait. And finally, he said he is too delicate, too sensitive. And to be a Jew in a public position, one cannot be sensitive, or at least overly sensitive. You know, my mother, a blessed memory, people used to say things, and I would come and say, you know, this person said this and this, and, you know, so she said that they're gezocht, so he said it, so, you know, like, so what? But there are a lot of people that if you tell them that so-and-so said something, he said something about you, he said, oh boy, then they're destroyed. They're unable to deal with it. And to be a leader, again, especially in the Jewish world, you have to have a certain amount of thick skin, a certain amount of insensitivity to others. You know, what they're gezocht, so he said, so what? And so Rav Yosef said on himself that he suffered from those three difficult character traits, and the fact that he was overly merciful, that he was too quick to anger, and he was too sensitive to what others said about him. He was an istinis. He was too sensitive to a lot of things, even physical things. And because of that, therefore, he himself characterized himself. He was held to be such a person of greatness and honesty that he was the representative of the poor in Pumpedisa. In other words, all charity was funneled through his hand. Just as in the time of Rabbi Akiva, the Gemara says that Rabbi Akiva was Yad La'anim. He was the hand of the poor. He was the administrator of everything that the poor needed. Rav Yosef was also the hand of the poor. Rav Yosef saw a messianic world, as I mentioned. He hoped that it would come. He said in the time of the Messiah, all of mankind will recognize Judaism and adopt its basic precepts. He declared that modesty was the great form of imitation of God. That was the imitatio Dei, because he said God, who is omnipotent and omniscient and beyond any understanding, is essentially humble and modest, because he made room, so to speak, for the world to exist. He makes room for people to make choices. He allows things to happen. That's an exhibition, so to speak, of God's modesty. And therefore, our task is to imitate him in modesty. He is a very intellectually honest person. We find in the Talmud dozens of times when he retracts statements that he originally made. And he said, now that I heard the other opinion, or now that I thought it over, I agree the other opinion is right, and I withdraw my original opinion. He was well known for the care of his aged mother. The Gemara in Kedushin says that when she came into the room, he always stood for her. He said, the Shechina, God's presence, enters the room. The Gemara, he, like many others, he prepared the table on Shabbos for the coming of the Sabbath. And he said the wise statement for which the Talmud is famous, Lav achbar oganav elachor oganav. It's not the mouse that is the thief, it's the hole that lets the mouse into the house. Meaning, it's the opportunity that is the thief. And that therefore our task should be, so to speak, to close the holes, to reduce the opportunities, and not to allow the temptation to take place. Because once it takes place, so then it's very difficult to overcome. The mouse was in the house already. He held that creating the opportunity for sin grossly magnifies the likelihood that sin will occur. But he was suffered from tragedies. He went sightless. The Talmud seems to, Rashi's opinion in the Talmud, in his interpretation there, is that it was almost self-inflicted. Either because of an incident that occurred. It's not clear from the Talmud what the cause was. But literally, smoke gets in your eyes. That's what happened, that somehow smoke from fire, etc., affected his eyesight and eventually went blind. And he went blind, so he had to teach by memory. Now, since he was the great Sinai, he was the man of encyclopedic knowledge and who had this great memory, so his blindness should not have interfered with him. But what happened is that then he began to lose his memory. And the Talmud describes that he would come to the yeshiva and say the shir and he'd forget. And that his students and his colleagues, especially Abaya and Rava of the next generation, would say, Rebbe, but you taught us. They would remind him. They, in effect, they would say the shir for him. But he came always and said the shir, even though now he couldn't see and he couldn't remember either. And so that really was a tremendous tragedy, that is. And he therefore taught the great lesson. He said that luchos v'shivrei luchos munochos ba'orom. The tablets of stone that Moses brought down from Sinai are placed in the ark, but the broken tablets from the first set are also placed in the ark. And by that he meant shivrei luchos, right? The broken pieces, which he said he himself was. He was the broken pieces of the tablets now. Couldn't see and he couldn't remember, but he's also in the Aron Kodesh. He's also in the holy place. He's in the yeshiva. Rashi's Rebbe, when he became old, also suffered from dementia, and he was unable to teach anymore. So they gave him the job of being to clean the Aron Kodesh in the yeshiva. He would come and clean it. There's a legend that he cleaned it with his beard, but he would clean the Aron Kodesh. But all the time he was in the yeshiva, they brought him to the yeshiva every day. Didn't send him away to a home. And the whole human tragedy is lived out here in this, in how the Talmud describes Rav Yosef, but it describes the love that his Talmidim had for him and the love that the community had for him. And that so the end of his life was not an easy thing. And when he became 60 years old, he made a banquet in honor of his 60th birthday. This is the origin in the Talmud for the custom of Jews, that when one reaches the 60th birthday, and then certainly later birthdays of significance, that one makes an event out of it. And he said, because until 60, one is in danger of the punishment of Chorus, of being cut off. But if one gets to 60 and the Lord has allowed the person to live, so he's past that danger point, and that's worthy of a special expression of thankfulness to God. And he made a Yom HaTova L'Rabbonon. He made a banquet for the students in the yeshiva to celebrate the death. I mean, to celebrate the event, I'm sorry. His funeral was an enormous event. Rabba's was a non-event, and his funeral was an enormous event. It says that the river was turned black from the number of people that lined, the thousands of people that came to pay their last respects to him. He was a very beloved figure. And he again, together with Rabba, he appears almost every two pages in the Talmud. Hundreds and hundreds of times he appears in the Talmud, Rabba and Rav Yosef. And they are the basis of this third generation of of Amoraim, they take us till about 330, 340 of the Common Era, and they are the ones that set the stage for the later generation of Abaya and Rava, and that'd be the fourth generation, and then after them already come Ravina, Ravashi, the fifth, sixth, seventh generations. After them is already the time of the editing of the Talmud completely, and the beginning of a different era in Jewish life completely. I want to only mention that, in effect, traditional Jews today live a Talmudic life. If you see in the Gemara, it's like the customs, the worldview, even some of the mannerisms, the hand going like this, that's all Talmudic. That's all, if our ancestors from Babylonia came down today, they would recognize us and we would recognize them. Not just in the fact that we're observant Jews, but in the way we live and the way we eat and the way we talk and even in the way we fight. Because all of that, the Talmud more than anything else has become part of the Jewish people. It's in the DNA of the Jewish people. I would be bold enough to say even more so than the Bible. And it's not an accident that you'll find scholars in the yeshiva that have difficult time telling you anything about Yeshaya or Yirmiyah or Yechezkel, but are experts in Bava Kamma and Bava Metzia and Bava Batra. Because the Talmud is really, that's Jewish life. And the Jews have lived with it for 1,500 years as part of ourselves, the way we see our community, the way we see ourselves, the way we see the land of Israel, that's all a Talmudic view. And these are the people that created that view, who transmitted it to us, and who through their lives were able to express it. And when the Talmud, therefore, everything that I've told you tonight, in this brilliant lecture, is footnoted in the Talmud per se. Every word the Talmud says, I did not create anything for you. The only thing is, the Talmud is scattered over 63 volumes and tens of thousands of words. And I've tried to organize it here into a more manageable fashion for us. But all of the stories, all of the biographies, all of the worldviews, all of the events, everything is in the Talmud itself. And because it's in the Talmud, it's undoubtedly true that the Talmud wanted us to know about it. Otherwise, they wouldn't have put it there. And they wanted us to know about these people. And they wanted us to know about their life experiences. And they wanted us to know about their triumphs and their tragedies as well. So then somehow we are able to handle our lives as also, and to be able to deal with the problems also, because we see how people far greater than we had their problems and their sufferings, and how they overcame that and helped build this great structure, which we call the Talmud, which is the basis of Jewish life until today.